Welcome to True Confessions of a Sales Leader. This is a podcast where sales leaders share the secrets of their successes and failures while offering hard-won guidance along the way. I'm Scott Olson, founder of the Olson Group. We're here to help you and your sales team develop the skills, system, and culture that lead to sustainable and significant results. Our mission for each show is to give you transformational guidance you can take and use immediately in your sales organization. Thanks for tuning in. Please enjoy the show.
All right, welcome back to another episode of True Confessions of a Sales Leader. Today we have two very special guests who have joined us on previous podcasts. They are Dr. Richard Ruff and John Hoskins. They are the creators of Level 5 Selling and co-authors of a brand new book called The Level 5 Sales Leader, Field-Tested Strategies to Close the Quota Gap. And we also have our regular hosts, Scott Olson and Gary Brashear of the Olson Group. Before we hear from Scott and Gary, Dr. Richard Ruff, Richard and John. Richard, would you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. First of all, it's great to be with you all again. Yeah, a little bit of background. I come out of an organizational psychology kind of background. I've had an opportunity to work with clients like Apple and Microsoft and UPS. So I've been doing the sales training thing probably for around 30 years. Right now, we're living in Phoenix, Arizona. We just moved here a couple of weeks ago. So we're trying to get settled among the boxes and so forth. So that's a quick background, a lot of experience in sales training, mainly with very large corporations, both domestically and internationally.
And John Hoskins.
Well, thanks, Melissa and Scott and Gary, for inviting us again today. My background is corporately. I started with Xerox Learning Systems Division, which was a sales training consultancy. And after that, moved into the bank consulting world and then founded my own firm in 1990 called Advantage Performance Group, which was subsequently sold in 2007. And Dick and I had a chance meeting at a Starbucks, I think in 2016, 2017 probably, and decided to launch Level 5 Selling. So that brings us to where we are today. I also am in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Well, you're going to have to send some sunshine our way to Oregon, if you don't mind.
I have a son in Portland. He tells me about the overcast.
Yes, we have a lot of green and a lot of rain here. We have our two very familiar voices on the podcast, Scott Olson and Gary Brashear. Scott?
Thanks, Melissa. Really excited about today's conversation. So we've spent the last 20 plus years really committed ourselves to helping our client sales leaders and their sales organizations achieve more than they ever thought possible and really find more fulfillment in the work they do.
And Gary?
Yes, I realized after hearing John's introduction that the reason that we, I think, relate is that my first sales training as a salesperson back in the early 80s was Xerox professional selling skills. And so I've spent my career both implementing these training concepts from Xerox to Miller Hyman and now to Level 5 in sales organizations, global and national sales organizations. So Scott and I have worked together on that where we're a team and we do that now for third-party organizations that want to implement Level 5 and other best practices.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. We're going to start this podcast a little bit differently. Now, normally at the end of our podcasts, we end with a rapid-fire question. But today, Richard, I'm going to put you in the hot seat. Are you ready for a rapid-fire question?
Probably as ready as I'll ever be. Yes.
All right. This question comes right from your new book. Mm-hmm. So now you're doubly in the hot seat.
Right.
True or false, approximately 10% more salespeople achieve their quota if they are coached regularly?
Yeah, it's probably not true. Coaching is a big deal, and it makes a big difference. So you can probably multiply that number by two or three times.
Yes. Well, in fact, according to the book, it is false. And 30% more salespeople hit their quota with regular coaching. This seems like a significant increase in revenue for any organization and enough of a reason to start coaching. But many organizations aren't prioritizing coaching. John, according to the book, a lack of time seems to be a big reason people aren't getting that coaching. How do frontline leaders do the necessary level of coaching given all of their other responsibilities?
Well, you've identified a big problem, Melissa. The number one thing that Dick and I hear working with clients when we talk about putting in a coaching system is the lack of time. And the common refrain is, you know, I have a day job and it doesn't include the amount of time you want me to spend coaching now. Most frontline sales leaders will tell us that they'd like to do more coaching, but the other things that get in their way seem to prevent that. Coaching is not necessarily something that's due Friday at 5 o'clock. And so it takes a lot of time and energy and patience. And the organization, particularly the senior sales leaders, need to work with the frontline sales leader to determine what are those factors that are interfering with them spending an adequate amount of time coaching.
Richard, one point in the book that I really loved was that simple and immediate coaching is better than comprehensive coaching later. Tell us a little bit about what simple and immediate coaching looks and sounds like.
Yeah, that's kind of an important distinction, actually. Let's take the simple and comprehensive. Imagine a coaching call, something like the following. You know, a manager has gone out with a sales rep, and after the call, says something like the following. You know, Sally, on the opening, I think you should probably spend a little more time, you know, developing a trust premise there. That was a little weak, and I noticed you didn't ask too many questions, and you need to probably up your game on that a bit. I don't know that the closing was a little soft. I'm not sure we know how to proceed here. So a couple more things I'll send back to you as well. Now, imagine if you're on the other side of the table and you're hearing all that. That's comprehensive. You covered opening and questions and closing, but is it going to be well received? And my sense is, if you're living in even a semi-sane world, probably not. It would be much better to focus. So a better kind of coaching visit would be where a manager would sit down and keep it simple. Beforehand, determine what you're going to focus on in terms of the coaching. For example, gee, Sally, you and I have discussed this, and questioning has always been kind of a tough spot for you. So on this call, I'm going to try to observe the questioning skills and give you some feedback at the end of it. So there, you're focusing on a specific behavior. People cannot absorb feedback on 4 or 5 different behaviors simultaneously. It's, first of all, attitudinally a little depressing. And just from a skill development standpoint, it just doesn't work. So keep it simple. Prioritize what you're going to work on. Agree with the sales rep on what that is and focus on that. It's not easy to take something like questioning. I spent a lot of time worked for Huthway for a number of years. Obviously, we're big time into the questioning model. That's hard to get better at. So focus on one thing and do that.
Scott and Gary, Richard mentioned that from an attitude standpoint or from a morale standpoint, listening to several pieces of feedback about your performance can be a little depressing or kind of a downer for people. And in the book, it does mention that from a brain science standpoint, we can only keep between 5 and 7 concepts in our brains at one time. So with all of that in mind, how do you advise leaders to keep their feedback simple and immediate? How about you, Scott?
Yeah, good point. One aspect on the attitudinal side as well is a best practice, an aha for me and a lot of our clients, is really to begin that coaching feedback, we want to start with something that was positive as well, something real. That's our kind of launching place, and then moving forward. And 5 to 7, that's that's a good number in general. And for these coaching calls, though, even minimizing it further down, you know, we think of the rule of threes, one, two, three, then I forget. So really, what's that single most important thing? And it's so tempting. You cover all these things and you know all these great things you want to share with the rep, but too much is too much and it'll just defeat the whole purpose.
Gary, how do you prioritize those three things you're going to coach on?
Well, it starts when you look at the framing. If you frame the process, a coaching process, it really starts back in the beginning when you have the initial conversations with each of your sales folks. Each of them, first of all, they need to have an open mindset, or you know, what we say a growth mindset. They want to improve because you only have so much time in the week. As John was saying, there's lots of other priorities for these frontline managers. I've been in that role, and you have to prioritize your time. So in the initial conversations, coaching conversations with the reps, you need to determine what they feel their three strengths are and what their three areas that they want to improve. And once getting that agreement, you can always bridge back as you're setting up the individual call coaching per what we agreed upon as far as your strength. As Scott said, you really did this well, and here's what you did that was really well done. Be as specific as possible. And in the area of improvement, if we go off the questioning skills, you know, we were really in the discovery questions. What do you feel you missed in the discovery that now, as we look back or listen to the call in the technology, listen to the call, what other questions might you have asked? And the coaching becomes then connected back to what the agreements, the upfront, what we call upfront agreements from the rep is, and limit that into those three. We believe in those three areas that you've already agree upon, and asking them upfront, how well do you think you did? Where do you think you could have improved in these areas that we're trying to improve in?
So, John, it sounds like the quality of coaching hasn't changed much over time. There's still the listening part, there's goal setting, there's simple and immediate feedback, all of that stays consistent. However, in the past year with COVID, people are now remote and things like ride-alongs perhaps are a thing of the past. In your book, you do mention that a ride-along would improve a sales leader by 25%. How do you see these changes now affecting the way people are coached?
Well, today it's Zoom-alongs instead of ride-alongs. And in some respects, that makes it quite a bit easier for a sales leader to be available for coaching. And of course, there's no, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles. They can be available almost in the moment. Someone could call and say, I have a call this afternoon. Might be good to have you on there as a coach. And they can just dial in. So that's a big change. And I think the importance of that in terms of maybe raising not only the volume of coaching, but the quality of coaching. There are some artificial intelligence software tools today that will objectively identify things that go on in a sales call that are targets for coaching. So the benefit of that, of course, is that it's not arguable. It's pretty sound and objective. Still needs a human touch to discuss the skill model that was identified as being something you want to coach. And I'd like to tag back to, you know, some of the comments that Richard and Gary made with respect to the whole ask versus tell. I think the model that Richard was, you know, displaying purposely was, you know, not the ideal, where you're telling this person all these things they did wrong. But the real art of coaching is being able to ask the right questions so that the person being coached comes to their own conclusions and has their own ahas about what they need to change behaviorally in order to be better at that skill. So that's a nuance, and it's a very difficult thing to learn to do. Richard's the master of it. Having lived his life in the world of asking questions, I think he's translated that very well to the world of coaching. And that's what we advocate in our work.
Richard, now I have to come back to you as the master of asking questions. Are you ready?
Yeah, it's the answers I struggle with.
So how do you learn how to make those questions? Is it a spontaneous thing because you've been listening? Do you have a list of questions you prepared way back when you agreed to coach this individual? Is it something that you just woke up one morning and realized, this is the right question to ask? How does a sales leader compose those questions, whether that's in the ride along or after a Zoom along, or even just via email?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. My general sense, having spent quite a lot of time with this questioning thing, is it's really hard. You really have to work at it over time. It's not something that you can wake up on Monday and pretty much accomplish by Friday. You have to systematically struggle with getting better at asking questions. And there are a couple of things you can do that helps. One is, if you look at really good coaches, one of the things they do is they solicit feedback on their coaching. So that's one way to get better at questions. You know, so after a call, you might say, well, you know, Jerry, were there things that I should have asked that I didn't? If you do that repeatedly over time, let's say you have a 10 or 12 person sales force, you'll get a lot of insight. So I think one of the keys is soliciting feedback from folks on your questioning skills. The other thing is that there are lots of good questioning models that can help you think through how to organize questioning. And the third point I might add is the other thing is almost always true is people who are very good at asking questions are also very good at listening. And most of us are not inherently good at listening either. So I would always tell people, if you want to get better at questioning, also look at the other side of the equation and research some of the skill sets that are common among those people who are good at active listening. Things like summarizing and testing understanding are good skills to develop if you want to get better at questioning. But I can tell you, I think when I've watched salespeople who are really, really good, they are really, really good at asking questions, and managers who are really good coaching are good at asking questions. So it's not an ordinary skill. It's a big deal. It's worth the time and investment to get better at it.
Do you think you have to have an inherent curiosity about coaching or sales or the organization?
Well, I think you have to be committed to getting better. And you have to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, like take today. I mean, we've gone through in the last year a tremendous transformational period. If you believe that things are pretty much like they were, you're probably not going to see much of a need to change. Well, there is a need to change. I mean, buyers have changed how they buy. Sellers need to change how they sell. So it's not some inherent talent. It's not a gift at birth, but it is something that you have to believe is important. One way to buy that is to watch really good people, and sooner rather than later, you'll recognize that they're pretty good at asking questions, so maybe it's worthwhile.
Gary, you seem to be a person who likes to answer questions and likes to ask questions. How do you, when you go into a new organization to do coaching, how do you coach around both listening and asking questions?
I don't see that on the script.
This is the fun of this podcast, is that we get off on tangents that are really interesting.
Okay. I appreciate that, Melissa. As I was listening to Richard intently, I agree with him that this is not something that you are naturally born with, the ability to ask good questions and listen effectively. And there are models out there to help us improve. It's an art and a skill, as the Olson Group. There's the framework, and then there's the art of implementing the framework. And I think good coaching, in my opinion, comes from the desire to help others improve. And for me, that's come from others who've helped me and contributed to my success by spending a lot of hours asking me very difficult questions. And so for me, it was from the experience of how much I grew and learned from great coaches that I was fortunate to work for. And so for me, it's a core belief that you want to help others improve the way others have helped you improve. The one thing that I ask managers, and I think I've mentioned this before, when they want to be a manager, especially a frontline sales manager that's been successful, most models is, okay, you've been really successful as a salesperson. Let's move you into a frontline manager, and then let's not give you any training. In today's world, organizations don't seem to do much training for that person who moves into the role. And the question I ask them when we get involved, because there's no one in the organization helping them, and someone realizes this person needs help, they're not doing well, we just had a call today on that specific subject, is, why did you want to be a manager? Is it for the prestige? Is it for the money? Is it for the recognition? Because if it's for that, and the underlying core is not that you want to help others succeed, I recommend you go back into individual contributor. So once you have the belief that you want to help others, and then you realize, as John said, you can only make these things, make people aware that this is an area that they might want to improve and get them interested in improving. You can't force them to improve in any specific area. They have to want to do the extra work, because most of this happens in the sales world on your own time. That's why when we say, hey, there's limited time for coaching, it's because there's so many other priorities. When do you do it? And my experience has been that you try to push off other things besides coaching and then do all the other things, the paperwork, the expense reports, all the things, the presentations that you have to do on a, Monday morning to the executive board on, here's your forecast and your pipeline. You're doing those things as a manager, you're doing those on your own time, because you want to do the coaching when people are available during the work hours. And so that's a lot of commitment. And some people want to do that and others don't. Personal preference.
Scott, we've heard a lot throughout the course of the podcast so far about building value around coaching. Richard and John both commented on it. Gary just discussed it. Scott, you've been in many executive offices trying to do that very thing. How do you build the value around coaching?
Great question. There's a need. Is there a want for it? Well, it's one of those things that pay now or pay later. And typically paying later is a lot more. And it's the, going back to like Stephen Covey's, model, the four quadrants, this is the sharpening the saw model. And so some think they can get away with it, talk themselves out of it, we'll do it later when I have time, which never happens. So building the one nice thing with the level five model is we have empirical evidence to show the results through third-party analysis. Specifically through the Brinkerhoff Institute, where they're able to, and it's a part of the program. People want to engage that, but it's studies the before and the after and the effects of it. So we can lay it out. Typically, we're able to suggest that they can double the number of what we call value creator calls. That's the really high quality conversations with customers over a 6-month period. So then we can think through in their environment, what might that mean for them? So it's not just a feel-good exercise. There's strong ROI behind it, and that we're all moving forward. So it's very, very powerful.
John, Scott's gone into the executive's office. He has convinced the team that they need the coaching. And then everybody sort of looks at each other and thinks, oh, this is a big, big lift. In order to not boil the ocean and tackle every single person and fix every single thing that's wrong and through coaching, how do you recommend prioritizing the coaching itself and the people who get coached?
Well, it relates back to the time issue. I think maybe at the contextual level, you'd want to ask the organization in the past when they've undertaken an initiative of this nature to install a coaching system in their sales organization, where did those kinds of initiatives, whether it was CRM or a new product launch or whatever it might be, where did those initiatives tend to stall or fail? And have that conversation up front to understand what some of the barriers might be or some of the obstacles you're going to encounter as you implement this. And it's really about how resilient the organization is to, as Dick mentioned, their ability to change, to move from one set of behaviors and expectations to a whole new set of behaviors and expectations for the front line. That's probably key. The other thing that I, just listening to the conversation here, that I'm reminded of is that often when people think of sales coaching, they think of it as something that's done after a call or during a pipeline review where you're coaching account strategy. But if you think about it, really coaching is something that should be done in advance of a call, in advance of pursuing an opportunity, to set the right expectations, to prepare and plan for a good outcome from that call. So, you know, back to your other question, is that we advocate planning as a 90-day plan where the manager looks at each individual on their team, and collaborating with them, they identify the three areas of strength that they want to have that person intentionally bring to their job every day, and then also identify three areas of development. And we limit it to that over the 90-day period for the very reason, you know, that we talked about earlier, is just it's too much to try to, you know, cover the universe of things that need to be improved. So that planning helps in two ways. One is that it's setting expectations for the manager in terms of how much time they're going to spend and who they're going to spend it with, but it also adds a lot of focus between the manager and the representative in terms of what they're going to be working on. So that's a big component. Most organizations, I would say, don't have coaching plans in place with the frontline sales leaders and their teams.
So, Richard, it sounds like you and John are really recommending focus as you approach coaching. In chapter 6 of the book, you do have a process or a thought process for how to identify who should get coaching. Can you talk us through that a little bit, who to prioritize with coaching?
First of all, I think it's a really important thing to think through if you're an individual manager, because, you know, most managers, you know, have maybe 10 reps reporting to them. If you simply take your time available and divide it by 10, that's probably not the best way to drive increases in revenue. I think you need to really ask yourself, how am I going to prioritize the time I spend on coaching? And the most fundamental question is, who am I going to spend time with first? And my sense is, you know, from watching folks and looking at the people who seem to be getting it right, that they consider two factors in making that overarching decision. One is the existing skill set of the person, but the other, equally important, is their willingness. And I think it's difficult to assess, but I think you need to get a sense about a person's willingness to be coached. You can't really improve performance by compliance. You can't say, you know, Jerry, you need to do X. You got to get commitment from the person. There's a big difference between trying to change behavior by compliance versus commitment. So for me, I would have, for example, a high priority on somebody who historically has been a very high performer, who has a real willingness to maintain that performance, but for some reason, they don't seem to be doing as well right now. I would spend time coaching that person. I'd find out, what's the problem? What's gone wrong? You've been a high performer historically. You want to get it right, and yet your performance is down. Let's spend some time working together to try to do something about that. So those are the factors for me. It's not just the skill. It's the willingness of the person. Coaching is a two-person thing. There's a person on the other side of the table. The manager can't do it by themselves. The other person has to want to change, has to want to get better. And if they're not, maybe they don't get as much of a manager's time, unless you can change that willingness.
Have you seen people change that willingness?
Yes. People lack a willingness for a variety of reasons. Some, I think, to your question, maybe never will change. And there's a set of psychological reasons that drive that. But some people are willing to change. They may not be cognizant, for example, of the need to change, because they say, well, things are pretty much like they were. Maybe you can help them think through that. Maybe they don't know how to change because they tried something and it didn't work. So you need to maybe take smaller steps. And that way they have a change in their willingness because they see it's feasible to change. And you need to encourage them. Change for all of us, no matter what you're trying to change, is hard. And so when people achieve something, you need to reinforce their accomplishment. Sometimes a little accomplishment goes a long way. So no, don't just assume that somebody may be hesitant is that way forever, ever. That is something that can be remediated.
So we all have potential for change and for coaching. I like it. Very optimistic.
Yes. And you know, maybe a little naive, but I'd rather go that way than the other way.
Yes, of course. That's what makes you a good questioner too, right?
Well, it helps. Yeah, I think you have to take that view. You have to work at it. But you also accept reality. There are people who don't want to change. Maybe they're in the wrong kind of job.
Gary, you've worked with so many sales teams over the years. Are you able to spot people who are willing to be coached, or do you need to do the digging and the research before you find the true gems in the coaching land?
Yeah, you have to. Well, let me back up for a second. When I was listening to Richard talking about commitment, you know, the willingness, first the willingness to be coached or be involved in coaching, it requires a commitment because it's a commitment of time and energy and the willingness to change. My belief and my experience with all of these teams that I've worked with is that that starts with trust. You have to earn the trust of the person you're coaching, of the team you're leading. You know, my experience has been when I go into and have gone into a new organization, you've got to earn the trust of the people that are on your team, because if they don't trust you to do the right thing for them individually and as a group, and if they don't understand the changes or what you're trying to accomplish, it's hard to gain that trust. So the transparency of the vision that you have to help them as a team and individually grow has to be accepted, has to be rational. There's always this Simon Sinek, why? You know, why? And you have to answer that question, why? You know, why am I here? Why am I trying? Why do I think coaching is a way for us to improve our overall performance? Because I haven't found a sales team or an organization that doesn't want, as me coming in as the leader, doesn't want me to grow that organization and revenue and performance and all the things that companies want to do. They don't say, oh, we want to stay status quo. Can you keep us at status quo? That would be just great. And so you have to convince people that the way to grow is to improve individually and as a team. That's how we're going to grow. We're going to get better at what we're doing day by day. And so I think it starts with trust.
Scott, as you've been out there coaching sales teams and sales leaders, how do you advise people to build trust as they begin their coaching process?
Going back to Gary's comments, with describing the vision and describing the game plan, getting feedback, insights, helping that may influence the game plan, and then following through. It could be as simple as make a promise, keep a promise. But we see this lots and lots of times where it's a big, here we go, we're all excited, and a big kickoff, but the follow-through is not there, and a great way to lose credibility and trust. You know, it's like, here we go again, or don't worry, this will pass soon. And so that's the real challenge, is that follow through effort. So some of the things we're seeing the best organizations do, you know, John mentioned the 90-day plans, mapping that out. But those frontline managers also need accountability. So, you know, we provide that initially, but ongoing, their managers need to have monthly, quarterly reviews and look at the insights. And we all need that. We all need someone to turn to and to share with, and have them hold us accountable and give us feedback as well. It's just a natural part of the process. So I think that's the key, is that follow through effort.
Scott, this is John. I would build on what you and Gary said. One of the things we do, Melissa, is offer an assessment of the coaching activities and behaviors of the frontline sales leaders at the beginning of the initiative. So we have a benchmark that we can measure at the end of the initiative to determine if they close any gaps. And one of the key questions of the 30 items in that survey is, my manager has my confidence, respect, and trust. And when they get that report back and they see, well, you know, I scored myself 4.75 on a 5-point scale, but I've got a range of answers here from, you know, 3 to 4. You know, I'm wondering, do I really have the confidence, respect, and trust of my team? So part of it is just making them aware of the importance of doing that.
I think that in many ways is a gift to the sales team too. It's a gift to the organization, but the team is made up of humans who want to trust their managers, who want to do a great job, and who want to feel safe. And so I feel even just that survey, John, that you mentioned, seems like such a huge gift to people, that perhaps those who don't feel confidence or those who don't feel that trust could turn that around a bit and develop a better relationship at the place where they spend 10 hours a day.
Well, for sure. And the manager's also setting an example, saying, I want feedback. I want to be coached. It's okay for you as a member of my team to give me feedback. I'm going to accept that feedback. We encourage them to meet with the team and review the feedback and talk about their own developmental journey to be a better coach. And so it sets the example that coaching is a norm, and it's something that all of us should do with each other.
John, you, in your book, you do have some assessment tools within the book itself. You do have some exercises for readers to work through. And one piece within the book that I think is really interesting is the Aspire coaching model. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So the universe, or I guess what you'd call the domains of coaching, tend to fall into three buckets. One is coaching the quality of a sales call. The second is coaching an opportunity and a sales strategy. But then there's that whole universe of coaching situations that sales leaders run into routinely that aren't related to coaching a sales call or coaching account strategy. It might be something like, you know, Fred is 120% of quota, but you've got a call from the head of the operations team saying that he's toxic and no one on his team wants to work with him anymore. Well, now you have a coaching opportunity, and you need to have a model, just like you have a model for coaching strategy or a model for coaching a call. You need to have a model for coaching those universal performance challenges that frontline sales leaders run into every day. It could be something as mundane of, you know, people not showing up on work for work on time, or coming to meetings late, or having a particular behavior at a meeting, or you get a call from a client saying, I no longer want John to be on my account. I mean, these are all conversations all of us as frontline sales leaders have had to have. And what the Aspire model does is gives you a roadmap for that conversation in order to, again, through questioning skills, find out just what it is that, you know, the reason for the problem and how you're going to fix it. It's a collaborative approach to having a conversation about a coaching scenario like that.
Richard, in your book and even in this conversation, we've talked a lot about unlearning bad behaviors. So whether that's showing up late to meetings, as John mentioned, or specific behaviors or toxic behaviors, when you look at the Aspire method, it's accomplished status, problems, ideas, being realistic, and executing. Which one of those elements do you feel is the most critical to tackle as you embark on a coaching model?
Well, I think my short answer to that is don't do that. I think the power of the framework is the fact that it is a framework and that each piece relies upon the other pieces. And so, for example, one of the pieces that people oftentimes forget is to really clarify the objective of the coaching. You know, the first letter in the Aspire model is accomplished. Well, that's all about clarifying the objective. So I would say, Melissa, that the notion there is to understand the necessity of following a systematic process and that both you and the person on the other side of the table understand what that process is and the reason that you're following it, and to understand the connection between the different pieces of the framework versus concentrating on one area or the other. That can be, for many people, a trap because they not only concentrate on that area, they literally forget the other ones. And in isolation, nothing works well. It's the magic is in the collection of pieces followed in a systematic way. It's harder, and it would be nice if you could just focus on one. I suspect it may be a trap.
I would build on that too, Melissa, by saying that the thing that we advocate in our work is that it's not just the frontline sales leaders that are learning these coaching models, how to coach a call, how to coach a strategy, how to coach a performance challenge. But we also advocate that those same models are taught to the sales representatives. So at some point, everybody in the organization is going to have to coach someone. A rep might coach another rep. A rep might coach a client. A rep might coach somebody in the staff. But they also could coach their manager. So there'd be nothing wrong with a rep calling a meeting with the manager to have an Aspire conversation about something that they're trying to resolve. So it's important that you don't have this scenario where, oh, you know, John and Gary went off to some training and learned the skill model. They're coming back and talking a whole new language. I don't even understand what it is, but we're advocating that they do share these tools with the representatives as well.
Scott and Gary, one thing that Richard and John write a lot about in their new book is that the coaches themselves become smarter. So it's not just about the sales team developing, but the coaches themselves truly evolve through this process. And perhaps this coaching extends beyond the handful of months that it's being implemented. Scott, as you go back and talk to customers you've had from years ago, or even a couple of years ago, how do you see their organization has changed as the result of the coaching?
Well, we see a coaching culture really take on a life. Some of the specific things we've seen, which is really exciting, where reps will take their calls, they'll listen to their calls on their own in the off hours on when we used to drive to work, but on the way there or the way to work, way home, or while they're working out, but listen and kind of diagnose. And it's this constant, never-ending improvement. It's not just an event, but it's an everyday. What can I do today to get even better? And they really have fun with that. And they are coming with challenging calls to share with others. Hey, how might you have done this? And so it's this open environment where we're all learning from each other, and it accelerates the learning. You know, I can learn from, you know, a challenging call that Gary had, and he can learn from a mistake I made or something that we did well. Often the reps would rather hear stuff from each other than the managers. And so that's really what we see over time, besides great results. And they say culture eats strategy. At the end of the day, it just creates this awesome culture that just gets stronger and stronger every day because it's this ongoing process, not just an event that takes place.
And Gary, I would imagine you have people who you have coached coming back to you. Maybe you coached them 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I imagine they come back to you with questions or for mentorship. How do you see them before and after your coaching?
I think the original question was around the coach improving and getting better. And I agree with that philosophy because even as a sales rep, when I was a sales individual contributor, I wasn't great at everything. No one's great at everything. Well, at least I don't know anybody, but maybe there is. I wasn't great at everything. And so as Scott was saying, being able to see someone else model a specific behavior that you're trying to improve. And we've mentioned it earlier, but the technology that John mentioned of recording the calls, and we use a platform with our clients called Rehearsal, where the managers can post the video clip of a best practice for a specific skill and then use that in the coaching with someone. That wasn't available 10 years ago. It's available now on demand. And so I believe that and I'm a technology person, my whole career was in technology. The technology has actually given us tools that makes coaching easier, more efficient, available 24/7. So for me, the payback, if you will, from spending time coaching lots of individuals is when I see those folks and we reconnect. You know, we do a bi-monthly leadership group of sales leaders. And, you know, the last call, there were two members on that call, two people on that call that were part of my teams. They're both in vice president level sales leader positions. For me, that's extremely gratifying that I had a little piece of helping them while I was coaching them. Both of them, we would have, they were very much interested and trusted me. We would have weekly coaching sessions. Not everybody wants that. Not everybody sees the value of that. So I see the representation, and I say this to clients or prospective clients, and that's why we love the Level 5 coaching system, is most people, when you ask them, do they think coaching is valuable? I would guess that 80% say yes. When you say, do you know the methodology and the best practices on how to coach? Most people say, no, I've never been taught that. And I think that's where what John and Richard have done is created this framework and methodology that can be rolled out in an organization that wants to coach, but hasn't had the best practices.
Okay. We started this episode with a rapid fire question, but that does not mean we're off the hook for the ending rapid fire question for this podcast. So here's the question. Are you ready, Richard?
Indeed.
All right. So you talked a lot about questions and asking great questions and listening and really thinking about people's goals as it relates to coaching. Put yourself into the situation of a person who is about to do some coaching. They've just had a virtual ride along or they've just listened in on a call and their mind just kind of goes blank and they can't remember any of the questions that they had thought to ask. What is one question they can keep in their back pocket for any situation that would improve a coaching session?
That's a great question. I think you do need to have something in the proverbial hip pocket. I think the question I would probably toss into that ring would be one that's related to feedback. The question is, would sound something like the following. You know, Jerry, we've been spending some time coaching Tell me how you think we might do a better job doing what we're doing. What might I do differently? Maybe some things that you could do differently. The notion of getting feedback on how things are going is something we tend sometimes to overlook. And you could literally ask that question almost any time. And I think it should be dual purpose. It should be both what I, the coach, could do differently, and also what you, the coachee, might do differently. Because when I've seen really, really good coaches, they are really open to feedback. And same thing with a coachee. They want to know how they can do a better job in being the recipient of coaching. So to me, it would be a question about feedback.
All right, John, now it's your turn. What is that one question that a coach could keep in their hip pocket?
I think you could always flip the role and say, you know, Melissa, rather than me take you through a coaching conversation that we've done before, why don't you analyze that call and tell me what you liked about it, what you thought you did well, and tell me what one thing you think you might want to do differently if you were to do it again.
Nice. So putting that immediate and simple feedback out into the world and letting them answer according to that concept of simple and immediate feedback. All right, Scott, are you ready? What is that one question a coach could keep in their back pocket?
So many one questions, and yeah, I'm debating in my mind which way to go, but I love Richard and John's responses. A question I would go with really kind of goes towards the how you want to end the coaching conversation, but what area should we practice more together? And then that would move, of course, into, well, let's practice this part of the call, but to kind of get that piece of it, because it's great to kind of talk through things, but at the end of the day, we want to practice whatever the key element is that can make the improvement happen. So that's what I would go for.
And Gary, you're going to end us today. What is your one question a sales leader can have in his back pocket when it comes to coaching?
What's the number one thing I can help you with that's going to make the most impact on your results?
I like it. Helps build that trust too.
Yeah, usually before that, I do what Richard said is give me feedback. How did I do on the call? We had a specific goal going into the call. I had a specific role. You had a specific role. We did that pre-call planning. How did I do against what we agreed to?
All right. This wraps up another podcast episode of True Confessions of a Sales Leader. We were talking about the book, The Level 5 Sales Leader, Field Tested Strategies to Close the Quota Gap by John Hoskins and Dr. Richard Ruff. John, Richard, thank you so much. Thank you, Scott and Gary, for another great podcast.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Great job, John and Richard. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Great takeaways. Hi, this is Scott Olson, founder of The Olson Group. If you found this podcast helpful and informative, don't forget to subscribe via your favorite podcast app or follow the show on Spotify. If you are looking to take your sales organization to the next level and accelerate the growth of your business, The Olson Group can help. Please feel free to reach out to me directly via email at scott@olsongroup.net or call me at 503-525-8866. Thanks again for listening.